Now entering Nerdist.com.
Big Pop Fun.
It's Big Pop Fun with Tom Wilson, the podcast gentle enough to use every day. But we do it once a week, so space it out if you can. I mean, you can listen to it over and over, but don't get all mental about it. Here's Tom.
Hello, everybody. Welcome to the Big Pop Fun Podcast with me, Tom Wilson, your somewhat laryngitic host this week. Sorry about that. Overuse and allergies have made my stentorian tones somewhat less stentorian. But welcome. Welcome to Big Pop Fun with Tom Wilson. I'm Tom. Welcome to another magical sleigh ride of enchantment and wonder as we say, ha, to the horses of our wishes and rise into a silky dawn of healing mists, sort of like something out of a Maxfield Parrish painting, you know, where for a moment we become little children on a swing held by the upraised corner of the crescent moon, and we swing under the moon. We don't fish off the moon, because that's somebody's logo. Who's the kid fishing? DreamWorks, of course. Yes, DreamWorks. We don't, that's DreamWorks' logo. We certainly don't want to impinge on DreamWorks' logo, because if there's one thing that, you know, Jeffrey Katzenberg and David Geffen and Steven Spielberg remind me of, it's a little boy fishing in a pond, sitting on the moon. I'm going to try to make this short. Hey, this episode of the podcast, as every episode from now on will be, I think you'll find, is brought to you by my new book, still new. So please download it if you have a mind to. It's called The Masked Man, on the Apple Store, on Amazon.com. It's available for Nook, iPad, Kindle, and every other e-reader. So please, if you haven't done it, would you do me a favor and check it out, because I actually think you'd like it. It's actually getting quite many positive reviews on Amazon and on the Apple Store. So if you like it, please feel free to review it. If you hate it, please feel free to confuse it with another book and give them don't give them a poor review. But I enjoyed writing the book very much, and I worked very hard on it. So if you enjoy the stories that I'm telling on this podcast, there are only way more of them and probably a lot better told in my book, The Masked Man. So please, if you would, go to the Apple Store or Amazon and download that. Many years ago, I met Judd Apatow when he was a teenager doing stand-up comedy at the Improv here in Santa Monica. There, it's no longer with us, that Santa Monica branch of the Improv, but that's where I met Judd, and we became friends. Judd was a very funny and energetic young comedian who went off. I've talked about it on the podcast before, but he went off to work with Gary Shandling on the Larry Sanders Show, on many shows, and ended up creating, executive producing the show Freaks and Geeks that I was on, and I played Coach Fredericks on, where I met my guest, Sam Levine. Sam, at that time, was, I believe, 16 years old, came from Fort Lee, New Jersey, and, well, we hit it off because we're sort of friendly, verbal, comedian-type guys. But Sam was very friendly toward me, and after only a year or so, he slowed down with the Back to the Future question. So congratulations on that, Sam. We talk about that. Sam was a big fan of those movies and made it very, very clearly known on the set of Freaks and Geeks and asked me a whole lot of questions. But we did have a lot of fun. Sam's a good guy. Sam is he's an actor of wide experience. And as I said, a native Fort Lee, New Jerseyan who came to Hollywood like I did, hopeful, industrious, asthmatic. Sam and I shared our asthma story. Sam was actually one day on the set of Freaks and Geeks wearing a T-shirt that said very simply, asthma is sexy. And it had the outline, like a logo, of the asthma inhaler that we all know. So I loved the shirt, and Sam was very nice enough at the end of Freaks and Geeks, when things were coming to a close, to buy as big a shirt as he could find with that thing. He actually went and he worked hard to get me my own asthma is sexy shirt, which it certainly is. Come on. Wheezing, it makes it happen, ladies. Come on. Am I right with it? I don't know. But I still have the shirt. It's one of my favorite shirts. I wear it at people like it because, let's face it, as I say, asthma is sexy, as is my friend and my guest on this week's episode, Sam Levine.
Big Pop Fun.
Sam Levine is my guest. That's two M's. Sam Levine. Why, can I just add, we open it up with namey stuff. Why yeah. Was the two M's a career thing, or was that when you were a little kid? It was Sam two M's.
When I was a little kid, in second, third grade, I think, I used to go by Sammy, S-A-M-M-Y.
Yeah.
And then I remember one of my teachers had said to me something about, are you going to be Sammy forever? And I said, no, I guess not. And she said, well, do you want to try writing Sam on your paperwork from now on your schoolwork? And I said, okay. And so I just dropped the Y because that's how I assumed when I was, you know, eight, that that's how you spelled Sam. And I remember I handed in my paperwork to her with S-A-M-M on it. She said, oh, honey, that's not how you spell Sam. And I said, well, isn't it my name? Don't I get to decide how it's spelled? And she said, well, that's not how anyone else spells Sam. And I said, well, that's how I'm going to spell it. And then I think I did that for maybe another just a few months. Before I went to Sam with one M, before I think my parents talked me out of it. And then when I was, I don't know, probably 14, 15, when I joined the Actors Guilds.
You have to have a different name than everyone, but they allowed you to just be Sam with two M's.
With two M's,
that
yes.
was okay.
Yeah, people have said, I'm surprised you can do that,
yes.
because if it sounds the same, you're not allowed to do
right.
it. Yeah, but I guess the previous Sam Levine with one M wasn't, he hadn't acted in anything in like 50 years.
Yeah.
But for some reason, he was still paying dues or receiving
right.
residuals.
Well, same thing. There was a Tom Wilson because everyone just called me Tom.
Yeah.
And I went to Thomas, and there was a Thomas, and then I went to Thomas F.
Yeah.
Like Michael J. J is not his middle
that's
initial.
That's right.
So you have to go
it's
to
like
a different
S
thing.
It's like the S in Truman.
Right. Right. Harry S. Exactly.
Yeah. Exactly.
So you grew up back east, didn't you?
I did. I grew up in North New Jersey.
And where? Yeah. In Bergen County?
Yes, in Bergen County.
I just guessed.
You did.
I
We've
guessed.
We've never discussed this.
We have never discussed this, no.
no.
So where? Bergenfield?
Fort Lee, New Jersey.
Fort Lee, New Jersey.
The gateway to New York.
Yeah, yeah. It really. Well, it's right across the river.
I grew up one block from the George Washington Bridge.
Did you go into the city when you were very young? A lot? Or?
As a youth, a genuine youth before the age of, say, 10, my family would go in at least once a week because my nana, my father's mother, and brother have lived in Manhattan proper my whole life.
And Nana's still there?
And Nana is still there on the Upper East Side.
Well.
Yeah. She's moving on up.
She's moving on up yeah. to the East Side, yeah.
yeah.
So you would go in every week to
We'd
visit Nana
We'd go in every
nana
week to visit Nana and my uncle.
What kind of, you know, what? Was it an overly romanticized view of the city then when you're that young going there? Or
no,
is that what it just is? Is that
I'm
what
sure
life
you,
is?
I'm sure you remember this. In the 80s, New York was a shithole. I hope I can curse on this podcast. It was awful.
There goes my clean...
You're not selling this to clean
no,
comedians. That's a little inside for you and me.
Yeah.
But New York was gross in the 80s. Remember that? Before,
yeah,
before Giuliani came in and cleaned it up?
Well, I do remember. Certainly the late 70s when I lived there. Yeah.
yeah.
It was quite
yeah.
something. Times Square was, let's put it this way, it was not like it is today.
No, not at all.
There was no Toys R Us
there was no
with
Toys
the
R-
indoor
yeah.
Ferris wheel.
42nd Street, what with its Chevy's and M&M store.
Nothing like that,
did that not
was
exist.
There. There were
yeah.
other kinds
other
of businesses.
Other establishments.
Yes.
So I remember... My parents, when we would walk down the street in New York, my mother would clutch my hand like it was the last chopper out of Nam. Like, you're not getting away from me. Yeah. My brother and I were not allowed to wander when we were walking the streets of Manhattan as children. But when I got a little older and New York a little nicer, that's when I started going in almost every day for auditions.
Yeah, I have never, on the podcast so far, I don't think mm-hmm. I've had an actual... kid actor, an actor who was an actor when they were a kid.
Right. Well, I was trying when I was a kid.
But you were not successful?
I had minor success. I mean, just mostly commercials.
What? How did that? How does that start when you're the little kid? Does mom just have...
No.
No.
Oh, it was quite the opposite. She did not want me to do it.
But you wanted to do it? Or dad? Or who?
Only me.
Only you?
Only me. Against my family's wishes.
Now, how old are you when you say, Mom and Dad, I want to go into the city and audition for parts in professional...
Well, here is the quick... Because it is otherwise a very long story, and we don't have enough tape. Yeah.
Okay.
We don't have enough tape.
There's not tape anymore. It's all digital now.
I don't care what you call it. We don't have enough of it.
All right.
So when I was 11 years-ish old.
And then Sam was an adult. I cut it even quicker.
You know what?
So
I wish we could tell it like that. You know what? From now on, that's all I'm going to tell.
No. What
I started
happened?
Doing stand-up comedy. For friends and family. I think we've talked about this.
Now, yes, because I know several of you, kid comedians.
Yeah.
Mark Price was like that.
Sure.
Skippy from Family Ties.
Yep.
And he was. This was Los Angeles, and I was an adult and everything, but his mom would whatever drive him around in the minivan, and he would come to the comedy store when he was... like 12 years old.
That is precisely what I did.
And sign up for the open mic nights and everything. And
I had a manager. I went in proper. I got
you
booked.
Had a manager?
I had a booking manager, yeah.
When you were how old?
By the time I was 13, I had
How do you get a manager when you're 13 years old?
You read Backstage Magazine at the behest of one Lisa Kudrow, who saw me do stand-up at a friend's bar mitzvah reception. She said, are you a professional? Are you an actor? I said, no. She says, really? You seem funny. Like, you enjoy it. Why don't you do that? And I said, okay. This is 1994.
And Lisa Kudrow at a bar mitzvah.
At a bar mitzvah. That is correct.
Walks up and says, kid, you've got it.
Kid, you've got it. I'm just an actor.
Really?
I'm not in casting, but you've got
it. So you go to Backstage Magazine and just...
And there was an ad in that very issue that said, are you a kid? Do you do stand-up comedy?
Oh, one of those kinds of managers.
No, but he was good. He was reputable. He was great because his son, his name was Sid Gold, and his son is Elon Gold, who I'm sure you know.
Sure, uh-huh.
And so I called up Sid Gold and went in and met with him and did some shtick for him, and he made me read some commercial sides. And he
so
said,
you did shtick in the office.
I had
like,
to.
Like Broadway Danny Rose.
Like Broadway Danny Rose, right. Yes. And he said, perfect, this is it. I want to rep you. I want to book you at clubs. I want to send you on auditions. And my mother went, whoa, hang on there, Sid. I don't know about this. I don't want my boy going down that life where it's all black and darkness and poor people. She said, no, maybe the stand-up thing once in a while, but I don't want him acting.
And what did your mom want for you?
To go to college and be a respectable member of society.
Like what kind of a thing? What did her dad do?
My mother's father
yeah,
was
grandpa.
A salesman. He was a traveling salesman.
Okay.
For the bulk of his life, and then he opened a lamp store. And I think they actually had several locations throughout the Northeast.
Throughout the tri-state area. What did your dad do?
My father's a dentist.
Dad's a dentist and mom, homemaker?
For the bulk of my younger years, a homemaker. And then when my brother and I were older, she went back to the workforce.
And what's she doing now?
Currently, she's working at a mortgage brokerage firm.
There you go.
Yeah.
In the city or in Fort Lee?
No, in Jersey.
There in Fort Lee.
Yeah.
So you could have gone into dentistry.
I could have gone into dentistry.
Orthodontia.
Possibly.
Oral surgery.
Yeah.
But you end up doing shtick at bar mitzvahs.
Yeah. And
in Parsippany.
In Parsippany, specifically.
So
I was the biggest hit in Parsippany.
Did you start doing stand-up in clubs in New York?
Yes.
Catch
I did them all. I did Catch, and I did Gotham Comedy Club, Stand-Up New York, Caroline's, Comic Strip, Comedy Cellar, Boston Comedy Club.
So most of that early stuff, most of those early showbiz dreams were stand-up.
Yes.
You wanted to be a big-time, whatever, stand-up? You wanted to do this tonight show?
Big-time. No, it was weird. I mean, I'd been seen a couple of times. I'd get lucky enough to get booked on a night where they were specifically scouting for Letterman, or at the time, the Rosie O'Donnell show was big on having kids who tell jokes. And I remember Judy Gold, who was at the time the booker for talent to come on the Rosie O'Donnell daytime show. She came and saw me do my act. And I had a great set that night. And then we called the next day, like, hey, what'd you think? And Judy was like, hey, he's good, but he's not what we're looking for. And my people were aghast. How could he not be what you're looking for? He's 14 years old. And the idea was, and then I hadn't watched the Rosie O'Donnell show. And so then I actually watched a few episodes, as many as it took to see some of the kid comics they had on. Mm-hmm. And they didn't have comedians. They had kids telling jokes.
Like a joke book joke.
Yes, like a joke book joke. And I thought, oh, you're right. I don't fit in there because what I'm doing is very different from what you have on the show.
Right.
Plus, I also worked a little blue.
You worked blue as a kid?
That was when you get the best laughs working blue.
Well, not if you work at it, and you know, not if you craft some jokes.
I had
and
jokes,
everything.
But it's very funny to hear a child say, vagina.
Yeah.
Especially one who looked as young as I did.
Uh-huh.
When I turned 16 and I still looked 13, 14 years old, I got very dirty. Well, not very dirty. I had a few dirty jokes, but nothing.
But when you were you were also auditioning for things. Commercials, toothpaste, whatever.
Whatever. I was coming in. Yeah, but my mother and I had a system down pretty well. She'd pick me up from school, and generally we'd head into the city. I would start doing my homework in the car on the drive-in. And then she would drop me off wherever I had my afternoon audition. She would circle the block because parking a car in Manhattan's Midtown,
you can't
do that. Mm-hmm. It's expensive and there's no spots. So she'd circle the block while I ran upstairs, did my audition, come back. Then we'd find somewhere that we could park. I'd sit in the car, finish doing my homework. And then oftentimes I had a set to do at some club that night, but they typically, my manager would only get me booked in early shows because I was so young. So I would do a lot of the 7 o'clock shows, 7:30 start times, and I would often be the first or second comic up.
That's a lot of work for mom.
Yeah, she was.
I mean, was she
a
enjoying
saint?
Herself?
Yeah. Yes.
Was she against it but trying to help you achieve some dream that you had?
Here's what happened. Here's what turned it for her. So when we were sitting there first in Sid Gold's office in 94, I guess, And he says, I want to have him repped in all areas. And my mother said, no, maybe the stand-up thing once in a while, but I can't let him be an actor. That's, you know, the chance of success is so minimal. And Sid said, I understand. Think about it. We don't have to decide right now. So we're driving home, and I talk about it with my mother and father, and they are really against it. And while we're sitting there discussing, Sid calls the house and says, listen, I don't want you to make any decisions, but I have an audition for Sam tomorrow if you want to go on it. You're not committing yourself to anything except one afternoon.
Right.
And so they decide, okay, fine, we'll do one, see what it's like. So then the very next day, my mother and I drove in, and I went to this audition for this toy commercial. And I sit there in the big room with, you know, 40 other kids.
Yep.
And it takes 3 hours for me to get seen. I finally do. They call me back the next day, and then they offer me the job later that day. And my mother and father went, on second thought, I guess we can let you do this.
So you booked the first commercial you read for,
a toy commercial I ever read for. The very first audition I ever had, I booked. It was for a toy that was ultimately never even made.
Mm-hmm.
But that, I think, is what turned my parents.
So Sid Gold.
Yeah.
Ace, A+.
Out of the
Elon
right
Gold,
first shot.
Up in the pantheon.
Absolutely.
Judy Gold, not so much.
Not so much. No. She's never been a friend. She's never been a supporter.
Does Judy still do comedy?
I'm sure she does.
Spit curl on her thing.
I think she has long straight hair now, or wavy. Mm-hmm. I think she got rid of the curls.
That was her like trademark.
Her perm look. Yeah,
thing.
I think it's gone.
Yeah. So what was the first? Like, did you get a big gig out of New York? Did something happen? Were you in a play?
No. I came close a couple times, but nothing ever really big. I mean, just a couple of, you know, commercials, mostly radio and voiceover for television was where I had the most success.
Like this sort of precocious kid?
Well, in the television commercial toy world, back in the mid-90s, the Spider-Man cartoon series, long before the Tobey Maguire movies, mm-hmm. Had spawned a lot of little action figure-y Spider-Man toys. And there were these series of, I think it was 8 different commercial spots that they had these same 2 kids starring in. And these kids had the right look, but boy, did they not have the right sound. And so that is where I came in. And so I would dub these on-air actors with the sound, And I would say things like, look out, Doc Ock, I'm going to get you with my web slinger.
So this was ADR. This was like looping it.
This was
like
looping
you would,
yeah.
You would go to a room and watch.
And watch these two.
These, the two kids talking
men,
on the screen.
On the, right. And when you were little. Match my, yeah, my voice to their
They have the three beeps, and then you
yep.
hit the line when that kid's mouth moves.
That is correct.
So you become his voice.
That is absolutely correct. And that was, and I did quite a lot of those. And I thought for a while, I'd been doing that, and that had happened many times over the course of, say, 2-3 years, where I would get called in to do things either just like that, or I would just have my voice on in a radio ad, and I was quite certain I was not going to be an on-camera actor. I was just going to be one of these voice guys, which I wasn't averse to, because I thought, well, this is, I don't have to shower before I come in here. They don't care how I look.
Like doing my podcast, basically.
Yeah. Oh, I am. Let your listeners know I'm in a robe.
Yeah. In a robe, unshaven, and stinking
yeah.
to high heaven.
This apartment smells
so
awful.
Well, Sam, we all hear in the pop culture of all of the kids who come out, you know, completely messed up, impoverished, and dad bought a yacht. And whatever, so they have no money,
yeah.
and their self-image is completely destroyed. In being an adult now, an adult actor mm-hmm. of a very, very significant body of work, but looking back
yeah.
in that kid,
yeah.
was that a good idea?
The only reason I'm going to say yes is because I have the benefit of hindsight. And in hindsight, yes, it was a good idea, because by the time I was the age that most people I know who have decided to try their hand at acting, by the time I was that age, I was already 7-8 years into it.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think you can put a value on that early head start that I was able to get.
Yeah.
In terms of learning the ropes of how it all works and making connections and meeting people. But
Did you miss anything? Did you ever, were you a social person?
Did you
go through things
wildly
thinking,
unpopular in school? So
you just didn't, you figured that's something that you could skip?
Absolutely. I don't feel like I missed anything with that. I wasn't enjoying myself before the acting thing started.
So you just started enjoying things when the acting started.
It was almost as if that was all I enjoyed. It wasn't that I enjoyed all of life. It was every minute I was sitting there in a classroom, I was counting down the minutes until I could go on an audition and act and do something I really liked.
Mm.
Yeah.
Interesting. So as an adult, when does it happen that you say, I'm going to continue this? This is my way of life.
Yeah.
This is what I'm going to be doing.
Well, it was
for money.
It was around the time you and I worked together on the little known show Freaks and Geeks.
Were you cast out of New York?
I
for
was.
That? You
John,
were.
Both John Daly and I were cast out of New York.
And how old were you when we did Freaks and Geeks?
I turned 17 while we shot the pilot.
Oh, okay. So you went how? Because I remember that audition process.
Yeah.
It was improvisational. It was it was loose. It was I think it took a couple more meetings and things to find out how comfortable we were with the material or with improvising.
Absolutely.
Or with that kind of a free form sort of production, which is what it became.
Mm-hmm.
But how did that happen? From Fort Lee. You were living at home and you went in by yourself on the train?
No, my mother would still. My mother drove me into virtually every audition I ever had in Manhattan. And so that was the very first pilot I had ever auditioned for was Freaks and Geeks, because I couldn't get pilot casting directors to see me because they didn't know who I was. I was just some punk kid in a bunch of commercials whose voice you might have heard.
Uh-huh.
But with Freaks and Geeks, Allison Jones, who was casting, I know that she was specifically looking for unknown actors.
Right.
With that show. So that's how I got my chance to come in and read for a network pilot. And I read once for her. And in the sides, in the character breakdown, I initially came in and read for the role of Sam Weir, the John Daly part, and it said he enjoys doing impressions with his friends. And as a working stand-up, I did a few impressions in my act, most notably my William Shatner, which I have never claimed was a good William Shatner impression.
Yeah, you just have claimed that it is.
It is an impression. I say nothing of its quality.
No, you do it and expect people to say that sounds something like
what people who do impressions of William Shatner
sound like. Yeah,
exactly. So. So I had asked ahead of time before I started reading on tape. I said, listen, I know it says he does impressions. I do the Shatner. Can I do that for you as well? And she said, sure. So I did
this. This is Allison.
I think it was actually Allison's associate.
Ah.
I don't even think Allison cared.
Allison, for people who don't know, Allison Jones, a very, very major Hollywood.
Emmy award winning
casting director.
Yes.
Of films and television. Yes. And Allison is... I must admit, I do not speak glowingly of casting people that much.
Yes.
But Allison has always been kind.
Always been kind.
And always been kind. When you get it, when you don't get whatever, Allison was always thoughtful. I met Allison when she was kind of, you know, an assistant to an assistant.
Oh, wow.
In an office over near the Fox lot.
Mm-hmm.
And she was just always... just very nice.
Yeah. No, always she's one nice. Of those casting directors who genuinely likes actors.
Yeah.
There are many who do not.
Well, that's what I'm talking about.
Yeah.
I'm talking about the thing.
Yeah.
Yes, when you get out of your car in Los Angeles or New York or whatever, and you go into that office expecting, you know, and you say, hey, I'm God's gift to acting, mm-hmm. ready to be, you know, they can be, well, quite negative towards you.
Yes, they can. Yes, just drop your headshot in the bin. We'll call you.
Yes, and curt and dismissive.
Well, could you maybe at least look me in the eye as I stand here in
your
office?
All of those things. Allison was was the opposite of that.
Yeah.
So you auditioned for Sam Weir.
Right, but I threw on that Shatner impression at the end of my read, and that tape was ultimately seen by Judd Apatow, who thought, well, he's a terrible actor, but this Shatner thing was ridiculous. And since Paul Feig is coming in to do the callbacks next week, I'll have this kid come in just so he can do the Shatner for Paul to give him a laugh.
Now, Judd didn't do that.
That is 100% true.
That Judd said, you're a bad actor,
well,
but I'm going to bring you in to do it. I think that's a pretty wild.
He's never told me specifically the words, you were a bad actor.
Yes.
But he did say there was nothing special about your audition except the Shatner. That is true.
Okay. So he brought you in?
So he brought me in
order
just to
do this William Shatner for Paul Feig.
Just to make Paul Feig laugh.
Who was, again, a big exec producer on the show and writer on the show.
Creator of the program.
And the director of Bridesmaids and many things. Mm. And the upcoming The Heat Tom Wilson.
He hadn't.
Secondarily, Sandra Bullock.
He had not done any of those important things first.
He had not. No, he had not.
Especially
Paul did stand up.
Yeah,
Did Judd.
As did Judd, So they both liked that I would do that. And so when Paul saw me, first I did the Sam Weir read.
The reading of
not
the
very good.
Of the material.
And then I did my Shatner form, and he laughed. And he said, well, hey, listen, why don't you read these Neil sides? I'd like to see what that sounds like. And so I went back into the waiting room, looked over these Neil sides, went back in, did the Neil scenes for him, and he said, I like it.
They said, wait a minute.
Wait a minute. This
kid is not terrible.
He is not bad.
He was miscast.
It was just an ill-fitted audition.
Yeah.
Yes. Then I went back the very next day to read for Paul again and now Jake Kasdan, the director.
Right.
And for the third time, I did my Shatner.
To Jake Kasdan.
For Kasdan.
Yeah.
And then the read for Neil. And then later that afternoon, we got the phone call, hey, they want to test you for this show in Los Angeles on a Tuesday. And this was like a Thursday.
So how did you feel?
I was over the moon.
What do you do when you're a kid, 16, you know, there in Fort Lee?
Yeah.
In mom and dad's place.
Oh, it was wonderful.
And they say, you're coming to Hollywood.
Oh, it was great. It was absolutely fabulous.
Did you do anything? Did you run around the apartment or did you just...
No, I kept very low-key about it.
Really?
Yeah. Because even though it was amazing and the opportunity like this had never presented itself, I think the fact that I'd been doing it already then 5 years... I knew most of the time you're not going to get what you want.
Right.
And I was sort of looking at it as, hey, no matter what, next week I get a free trip to Los Angeles, where I'd never been.
Mm-hmm.
Next week I get to stand in front of the National Broadcasting Company and make an ass out of myself. And regardless of what happens, that's pretty special.
And you're doing the Shatner.
And I get to do Shatner.
For the studio heads or the network people.
Judd had such clout. that he convinced DreamWorks, who produced the show, they did not need to test actors, that all of his actors should just go straight to network. And in all my years since then, I've never, ever had that experience again. No studio I know has ever trusted any producer enough to automatically approve anyone that they want to just go straight to
network. How did Judd get that kind of power at that time in his career, in your opinion?
I don't. He's very persuasive, and I mean, he wasn't completely unknown. He had Larry Sanders' show.
Right.
He had the Ben Stiller show. He had the Critic, which I loved.
Right, right.
Yeah. So I think I don't know. And also, he had a good relationship with the guys at DreamWorks. Justin Falvey was believed in him.
When you came out here, you're a teenager,
mm-hmm.
and you're getting off the plane.
Mm-hmm.
What were your first impressions of Los Angeles?
It is warm for February.
So really, it's the same as anybody who comes from the East Coast. You get off the plane and you just go, well, look at this. There's no snow on the ground.
I remember I wore my winter coat because it was like February 16th
mm-hmm.
or what have you in New York. So it's 10 degrees outside.
Right.
And I wore a winter coat to the airport. And I land in Los Angeles and it was 81 degrees. And I went, well, this is fabulous. Pardon me for 1 second. This may be an emergency.
Sure.
So let me just.
Sam was just on the phone with the, who was it, the producers
that was
of this
the,
new
the,
pilot?
Yes, the producers of this pilot that
you
I
got.
Shoot.
So you got cast in a pilot that
yes.
you're shooting when, next
I'm
week?
I'm shooting in about a week, yeah.
So they had to call you to congratulate
yeah,
you, to welcome you to the pilot family.
It's And I'm thrilled to be a part of it. It's
excellent.
Very exciting.
We were talking about getting off the plane in Los
yes.
Angeles and going to
the network test for Freaks and Geeks. Well, I'd never seen palm trees in person. I'd never been to Florida from New Jersey, so
uh-huh.
I'd only seen palm trees on TV, and that sounds silly, especially now that I've been surrounded by palm trees for well over a decade. But at the time, I remember thinking, ooh, palm trees.
Right. Was the test in Burbank?
It was. It was at
NBC?
The NBC studio mm-hmm. where they shot The Tonight Show.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. Where they still shoot The Tonight
I
Show.
I guess they still do.
They certainly do. It's Jay Leno now.
Oh, right.
Yeah.
At the time.
Was it Johnny Carson back then?
I wish. This was 1999.
Okay.
Yeah, no,
I forget
been
the dates and everything.
For 7 years.
Oh, in my day, you know, when Jack Parr hosted. I don't know.
No, you don't.
I don't remember that.
Steve Allen to me.
No. When you test for a pilot of a show,
mm-hmm.
you go, as you did, to Burbank Studios, to NBC,
mm-hmm.
and there are, how many actors would you say were there? Five?
Well, they were reading several different roles that day.
Okay. So there are a lot of actors,
there
but
were,
maybe
there were a good
five
handful
for
of us.
Neil or th- six
I think
for
there
Neil.
Were actually only two actors reading.
Two.
For Neil, yeah.
What happens, folks, is you get your agent does all the deal making and everything.
Yeah.
So the deal gets completely made before they decide to cast you in the role.
And people will say, well, I don't understand. Why don't they offer it to you? And then you say, this is because they don't ever want the actor to be in a position to have power over the network.
Exactly. So they make a deal, let's say, with Sam. We'll make up Sam's deal, and we'll just say Sam, and it's we'll say it's $5,000 an episode.
I wish I got that.
Yes. To actor B, it is $8,000 an episode. He will not go down.
Yeah.
To actor C, it's $17,500 an episode.
Yeah.
And then to the big star guy,
mm-hmm.
who you would love to be in mm-hmm. your show, but to him it's $50,000 an episode. Now, before everyone auditions, they present you with all of your paperwork.
Yep.
You are literally signing all of the contracts mm-hmm. before they decide that you're even the guy.
Yep.
So that when everyone auditions, quote unquote, against each other, though we're all an acting family.
No,
aren't
it's
we?
If I never audition against.
Right.
Alongside.
Yes.
That's how
we audition for something. But so the network and the studio and everyone knows, well, if we pick the. Sam, what is this?
I wanted to turn
what
it off.
What is this?
I tried to turn
Come
it off.
Come on, man.
Just,
I'm going to pause this again. But the final warning, Levine. No, I'm pausing it. Last time. Well, it's 3 months later. Finally, we're back in Sam's apartment after a season. No, it's just, look, this happens. This happens
it's,
in especially
timing.
In the houses of actors.
The timing is terrible.
Is something that you're doing a pilot and you're doing another show and there are conflicts.
There are conflicts, and these are problems I so rarely have.
Isn't it amazing? It's miraculous when it rains, in a negative way. But when it does rain, it does pour. And if you can go 8 months without a job of any kind, there are tumbleweeds tumbling across the terrain of your entire career.
Yes.
And then you get a job for 2 days.
2 days.
That will not even get you out of the hole you're in.
No.
So you say, well, you know, at least it's a job.
Work is work.
We'll take 2 days of this job and everything. As soon as you say, okay, goodbye, the phone rings back. And they say, we need you for those 2 days. What are you doing?
How could you do that to us? But it's 2 days. I'm not even working. Those are hold days.
I thought we were friends.
Well, hold
now
days.
You've turned. Well, Tom's turned his back. Sam's turned his back on us.
How do we know what the schedule is going to look like a year and a half from now?
So
why are you crushing me over it?
It's just crazy making. Yeah. It's crazy making, and it's making you crazy today.
And I apologize, but I am in this moment with you. Do not let that.
Not really so much. Come on.
100%.
100%?
100%. You and I'm right here with you right now.
Wow.
I remember where we were going with this.
When we first did Freaks and Geeks, had you ever been on a set like that before?
Absolutely not. Absolutely nothing like it.
Because as people know, were you and I together in the improvisations that we were doing on video before we shot the show?
Unfortunately, we were not. I met you on
the set.
On the set of the pilot. What was strange about the pilot was I think the first two or maybe 3 days of the pilot shoot were all the freaks.
Oh, right.
And so John and Martin and I were only on set because by law we had to do schooling on set.
Ah, so you had to come to the set just for the social worker, just for school.
Exactly, just to do 6 hours in the trailer.
Martin
the school
Starr,
trailer.
John Daly.
Yes, we were all minors at the time.
Yeah.
And I remember we took a break from schooling so that we could meet some of the other actors, especially you, who all three of us were really excited about meeting.
But you were the only one who said it. The other two, no.
I told you what a tremendous fan I was. And
you were very kind.
And this was back when you did not realize you were going to have to put up with me for an entire year, so you were very nice about it. And when I mentioned Back to the Future things, you were very polite, and you gave me the very style. That's very sweet. Thank you so much. It was a lot of fun. Really glad you liked it. Cut to like 6 months later, and you were sick of me with that shit.
No, what did I say?
Do you really want to know? I will tell you verbatim what you said to me, because it's still hysterical to this day.
Okay, what did I say?
So that was in February of 99, and then the show gets picked up. We're back working in July.
Did I give you like three final questions or something?
This is what you said to me. You said
because people must understand that Sam.
Oh my God! Yes,
I was being very pale. We're friends,
absolutely.
But you, let's face it, had a real
problem
fixation on this movie.
Absolutely, the whole trilogy.
Yeah.
I would not stop. I was badgering you.
And this is, if I may say, this is. And you're a teenager, and that's fine. And we are, I'm like, I'm at work.
Absolutely. Yes.
I have
you're
things
trying to focus
do.
On your craft.
Right. I have
and
like
I want to know where my hoverboard is.
Exactly.
Yes.
I have scenes to do, lines to memorize.
There is no question, looking back on it, I was the villain in the equation.
I don't say, oh, you're a villain.
No. Villain.
Okay, villain.
You were completely in the right. But at one point in approximately August, you said to me, you know what, Sam? Here's the thing. It's 1999. Come January 1st, 2000, it will have been 15 years since Back to the Future. And while I'm proud of the work I did, I don't want to keep having these conversations with you every day. So I'm going to declare a moratorium on Back to the Future-related questions for you that is in effect January 1st, 2000. So from now until then,
I remember that.
All the questions you want.
Have at it.
Have at it.
Because then the door
because
will
then
close.
It's over. Then we're done. And to my credit, I respected that.
You did respect that.
And I went home and wrote a whole list of things I might want to discuss.
Yes, you had a lot of questions.
And I spaced out the list.
How was I back then on answering them? I mean, did I have reasonable answers for you?
You had fantastic answers for me.
I can't even think of the answers. I think it's such mush in my head that if people ask me something, I just go, I don't.
Right.
I don't know, man.
And now having been 13 years since Freaks and Geeks, the shoe is on the other foot, sir.
So that has actually happened to you.
I have not had to declare moratoriums on anyone because I haven't had steady work since then, but certainly as far as fans who approach me are concerned, I have answered the same six questions 10,000 times.
I suggest getting a guitar.
or a tuba.
Yes, or a tuba, and making it through music.
Yeah.
The answers through music, because heart speaks to heart.
You are correct, sir.
Have got to feel some of that.
Absolutely. And so I can only imagine if I were working on a show in a regular capacity and had to encounter the same young actor who I don't want to be mean to. We're co-workers. He's a young man. He means it with the best intent. But still, really, every day you want to know what Martin Starr's cologne was in 99? I don't know that.
Right.
You're very sweet. I'm glad you like the show, but come on. Let's focus on the now.
But you had not experienced really acting on a set like that.
No, nothing close to it.
So it was very, I wouldn't say it was very improvisational, but there was a freedom within it.
Absolutely.
To allow you to go off the page a little bit, to wander within a scene.
Very much.
And that was really supported by Paul,
Jake Kasdan, all of our guest directors.
What was that like? The kid who's just doing toy commercials, mm-hmm. who comes from New York, who wants to, you know, memorize the lines, not make any mistakes, do well.
No. You're talking about someone who's, professional.
Cares?
Professional.
Oh, professional, yeah.
Yes, no, I've never been professional. I consider myself really lucky if I get 80% of the lines right in any given scene. And so I welcomed the freedom within the scenes to make it your own, mm-hmm. and have fun with it. And so that is how some of my most memorable scenes wound up on the show. Is, I know these aren't the right lines, but whatever, this is probably how I'd say it in real life anyway, so let's see, mm-hmm. if it works. And a lot of times I got lucky and it did.
And a lot of times, whomever was directing the episode, mm-hmm. would just let the camera keep rolling.
Oh, yes.
And would just not call a cut.
Just to see what happens.
To see if anyone says anything else.
Yeah.
The entire scene between Martin and myself when he's watching TV,
mm-hmm.
He's watching Dallas.
Yep.
And I'm behind him.
Yep.
And that was the scene that was over.
Yeah.
The scene was over. And they just kept the camera rolling.
Right.
So, and he just says, whatever, that's Jerry.
Because then you wanted to know, tell me about the show. And
right.
And what was very funny was I vaguely remember Martin Starr knew nothing about Dallas, and why would he?
Uh-huh.
In real life, he was born long after that show had
right.
come and gone. And so I think he was telling you virtually all he knew about the show that he had heard,
mm-hmm.
from
right.
the older people.
Right, right. The older people.
I remember when we were shooting one of the episodes, Seth Rogen, who is actually just a little bit younger than I am, if you can believe that, did not know the Who song was named Baba O'Reilly.
Oh,
Which he has to angrily point out to Linda Cardellini in an episode. And I remember when we were doing a table read for that, he had said, the name of the song is Baba O'Reilly. And I chimed in. It's Bob O'Reilly. But a lot of people think it's Teenage Wasteland, so don't even worry about it. And
what was the relationship? Because it was under my radar.
Yeah.
I was just approaching it like a job.
Yeah.
And of course, I was friendly to everyone.
Well, sure.
Is this a question you get a lot? But I wonder what was the actual relationship between the freaks and the geeks? What you and James Franco,
right.
you know, you and Jason Segel, you and right. Seth Rogen.
There was not a whole lot of spillover, at least not from me and certainly not from John. I know Martin hung out with Seth a lot, but when you're teenagers, every year can create a chasm of difference.
Oh, sure. Demographic,
yeah.
that is very a very narrow niche.
Absolutely. So the bulk of the freaks were 19, 20,
yeah,
21,
they were older
and
than
above.
You guys. Mm-hmm.
I was the oldest of the geeks over Martin just by a few months. I think his birthday is just a few months after mine. And John, like I said, he was just 14, so he was a kid,
right.
for all intents and purposes. But, I mean, what I would have in common at 17 with James Franco, who was 21, I mean, there's no, you know, I was this
other
sheltered
than
kid.
Your incredible good looks.
Other than that, which oftentimes when people stop me, they think I'm James Franco at first.
I thought that I was doing the podcast with James Franco.
I apologize for letting you down.
Yeah.
And you expected me to have one arm because, as you know, I am method.
Yes.
And
James is quite a movie star now.
Oh, James?
Seth is quite a movie
Seth
star
Rogen,
now.
Jason Segel's
quite a movie star
we
now.
We have three pretty much A-listers.
Bonafide movie stars.
These guys say, I want to do that movie. That movie's getting made.
Yes.
Yeah.
Dave Gruber Allen, movie star.
Movie star. No question about it.
I only wish.
And conquering the world of television, Busy Phillips.
Yes, Busy Phillips.
On Cougar Town. Great. Linda Cardellini had a very great run on ER for a number of years. This would go back to Allison Jones. Talk about having an eye. What are the statistical likelihood that even one actor from any given show would go on to tremendous success is so low.
What do you think that is?
It's definitely it's a combination of things. The first is talent. I don't think a person, we had a single actor on that show who was not phenomenally talented, myself excluded. I was just the lucky guy.
You're being a little self-deprecating
here. No, not Pete
here.
Best. I was Ringo. They needed a drummer.
You were really?
They needed
so
a
they
Jewish
went to
kid.
You were just Ringo? In your mind?
In my mind, I'm Ringo to that show. Yeah.
Truly.
They needed a Jewish kid.
And you ended up to be the Jewish kid who could do...
Right.
Who could do
Shatner.
Shatner.
Yeah, absolutely.
When the show ended, I mean, what was that like? Because I remember, you know, this is a show that, and it's wonderful that I always, you know, I'm just so happy that something happened in my life where a segment of the population will come up to me and said, hey, you're Coach Fredericks from Freaks and Geeks. So I have to do that conversation that you... Well, first of all, what are the three big questions? Or what's the one big question people come up to you in the airport?
They often want to ask me if I still keep in touch with the cast. That's a popular one.
That happens to me, too.
Mm-hmm.
Because we're all supposed to be friends forever after a job that we do.
Obviously.
For example, when someone puts aluminum siding on a house.
Yes.
You go and check back a few times a week.
Obviously.
From that point forward.
Do you know how many friends I have made fixing up this apartment?
Of course. But do you still keep in touch?
Do you still keep in touch with the cast?
So do you?
John Daly and I have remained very close friends.
That's
since
great, because John's a great guy.
Yeah.
Great guy. And
also,
taller than me.
Enormous.
With a deeper voice than I have.
I want to punch him in his handsome face. And talk about the success he has now as a writer.
Yeah, absolutely.
It's phenomenal. And he's directing the new National Lampoon Vacation reboot. I'm very jealous, and I want to punch him in his handsome face.
Well, what are you up to?
Well, I got this pilot that I'm doing.
We'll talk about that in a second. Let's go to the Freaks and Geeks.
Yeah.
It's the only show, as I said, and I was in Back to the Future, but it was the only show where the New York Times, I mean, big LA Weekly, people, you know, these media critics are doing stories saying, please don't take this show off the air.
Yeah.
This is a fantastic show. Please do CPR or something as it gets pulled and it goes up against whatever it was, the Winter Olympics any kind of, you know, against the World Series or whatever those things were.
Mm-hmm.
It just kept getting hit in the head with a mallet.
It was. It's like, I don't surf, but I've heard people talk about this. When you get knocked over by a big wave and then there's a series of waves behind it. Every time you come up and you're able to catch one breath of air and you think you're safe, boom, another bigger wave hits you and knocks you back down again.
So that's happening to the show.
Absolutely.
As critics and that small audience that was growing is saying, please, it's a great show, but it didn't make it.
No.
So what was that like for you coming to Los Angeles, your first show?
Yeah.
It's a critically acclaimed show, and everyone's saying it's great. Except it just doesn't anywhere.
The writing was on the wall for that show's demise.
When?
While we were shooting it.
Mm-hmm.
When, for me, it became clear the network was not, I don't say behind it, but was very hesitant about getting behind that show when I had heard everyone kept saying, talking about the back nine, which is the, as you know, the industry term for when they pick up a pilot, they typically pick up 12 episodes So that plus the pilot's 13. And then if the show is successful, the network will order the back 9 episodes, making it a total order of 22. So everyone's talking about, oh, we're going to get the back 9. We're going to get the back 9. And then I hear from Judd and company, hey, guys, they ordered the back 1. I'm sorry, what? They've ordered 1 additional episode. And we're going to be pulled off the air for a couple of weeks. And they're going to relaunch the show in January. And the president of the network has said, if the show doesn't get X amount of viewers, it will never air again. And we got very lucky that we aired exactly the amount of viewers they said we could not fall under.
Mm-hmm.
And then the network ordered the back 4. So after the order of the back 1, that's when I said, ooh, this might not keep going. Mm-hmm. This great, amazing thing I'm
doing.
You're
not flatlining, but things are...
We are on thin ice.
Life
here.
Support, yeah.
And I had been... I've always considered myself a fan first in the entertainment industry. I have always been a tremendous movie fan, a tremendous television fan. I soak it up. And I had seen many quality shows come and go on television many before their time. And so it was never a question to me of, but the show is so good, how can they take it off? I always thought of it as a business. If it's not getting viewers, I can't blame them. We came in 93rd in the Nielsen's, the lowest rated show on any major network.
Mm-hmm.
If I'm running the company, I'm not keeping that show on TV. But, I mean, it's more than that. It's they didn't promote it, so why would anyone watch it? No one knew it was on. We aired, I think, at most 4 episodes in a row in our entire run. Mm-hmm. They never had more than 4 in a row, and you can't build an audience like that. And so it was the perfect storm of this brilliant thing was never going to last.
How'd you hear about its demise?
It was still, to my memory, one of the worst days of my life. The day I heard about it getting canceled. We wrapped. We had a big wrap party. It was a lot of fun. And that was on my 18th birthday, our wrap party. And then I wound up getting a job as a writer on a game show on the USA Network called Strip Poker.
Mm-hmm.
It was Emmy Award winning, I think. Peabody. That's what it was. Peabody's. And so I was riding on this show, driving my old beat-up car, and I'm driving to work, and my car dies as I'm pulling into the parking lot. So now I have to deal with this, my old dead car. And so I called AAA, and they come and they take the car away to, you know, shop, and I'm finishing working the day thinking about, ugh, my car, and things aren't going well, and I was having trouble at work. And then I call J. Elvis Weinstein, one of the writers on Freaks and Geeks, and a pal. And I said, listen, I'm working on this show, and I'm stuck here, and they took my car, and I kind of need a ride to the garage later. And he says, sure, I'll come get you. So he comes and picks me up, and I'm already, like I said, having a pretty bad day.
Well, you're writing for Strip Poker on the game show.
That did not add to my my mental state in any positive way. And he says, hey, man, I have some bad news and some worse news. And I said, okay. He said, Freaks and Geeks has been officially canceled by the network, and Paul Feig's mom passed away. And we all knew Paul's mother. Yeah. And we all adored Paul's mother. She was on the set a lot, and she was maybe the nicest human being I'd ever met. And, I mean, that was bad news. It was, you know, it was a bad, bad day. And then I wound up, I was so upset, and then the elevator in my apartment building didn't work, so I was taking the stairs, and I'm walking up these kind of outdoor stairs, and I trip, and then I put a gash in my leg.
Oh, you had to finish it that way.
Really?
You really have to.
The day, I was like, well, this day could get worse.
Right. If you didn't
if I could only really injure myself.
Of course.
To the point where, ooh, this might need stitches.
If it wasn't an accident, you probably should have just driven a scissors into your thigh.
I was considering
just it. Why not?
Just to finish off that day. And it was a bad, bad day.
Mine wasn't that bad. I got the phone call with, I've got good news and bad news. The good news is you're going to be a regular on the show. You're going to marry Bill's mom. And come on a lot of episodes.
Yeah.
And it's going to go great. Maybe even direct an episode next season.
Oh.
And we're canceled.
Well, you know,
who made that call to you? Oh, just a funny, funny, unkind person.
I don't care for this at all.
No, but after that, were you writing more, or what did you do in the?
Well, so after that, I'm now in Los Angeles without a job prospect. My run on the writing thing only ran another week or so.
So you lived here and you'd never moved back.
That is correct. So I made a decision to myself. The first decision, or I made two decisions. The first was, do I want to stay here and really try at this acting thing? Or do I want to go back to the East Coast and go back on the path that I had started for myself there? And I decided L.A. was the place I should be to continue pursuing acting. The opportunities out here were tremendous compared to, at the time at least, what was going on in New York. There was virtually no production there other than soap operas and Sex and the City. And since I was neither extremely attractive or extremely attractive and gay, I had no place on either of those shows.
Mm-hmm.
So I decided I would stick it out in L.A. And then the second decision I made was, okay, if I go 6 months without booking more acting work, I will enroll in college courses here in Los Angeles because I do not want to limit myself to just being that kid actor that everyone knew with no formal education and no ability to get a real job later in life. And 2 months later, I booked another pilot that I shot for the then WB network, which sadly did not get picked up. And then after that, I said, okay, the 6 months starts again. If I go 6 months, no job, enrolling in classes. And then I booked some work back on the East Coast. And then every time after that, I got a job and the job ended, the six-month clock started again. And through some bizarre stroke of lottery-type luck in the 12 years since then, I have never gone 6 months without a job. And I consider myself unbelievably lucky.
Do you want to raise the stakes and say, okay, within the next 6 months, if I only get two cruddy jobs,
sure,
then I will enroll in college. If you enrolled in college, you probably won't now because it's 12 years of doing pretty well.
Yeah.
Pretty well, yeah.
I'm okay.
You do okay.
I do all right.
What would you have enrolled in? Or what would be your secondary? What would you fall back on?
Oh, God. Well, at the time, I might have made the mistake of enrolling in some sort of film school.
That would have been a mistake.
That would have been a terrible mistake.
Yeah, that would have been a mistake.
Because the education I've gotten being on sets versus the education I know friends of mine have received in film school, very different. The theory versus the practical is night and day.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm glad that I did, and I don't want to shit on people in film school. That sounds terrible. If you're in film school, soak up everything you can. You know, I'd say focus more on film appreciation.
Well, you certainly appreciate films.
I do.
We're here in your apartment at an undisclosed location.
Thank you very much.
Here in the, you're centrally located
in the San Fernando Valley
in Los Angeles.
I believe you were the person who told me where we are sitting right now. Fodor's Los Angeles Guide 1996 considered the most centralized location in Southern California.
That it is.
You told me that.
That it is. Well, you can get anywhere from here, as you well know.
Mm-hmm.
But your shelves are just lined here. We've got, I mean, hundreds upon hundreds.
Yes, well over 1,000 mark.
Well over 1,000 or more, yes, of DVDs.
Yeah.
So you're quite the film buff. You've watched clearly a lot of movies.
Yes.
Unless you just have not watched these and you just want selection.
To be honest, I have not seen at least 80% of these. They merely exist.
Are you? What no, you're kidding me now.
I'm 100% kidding you. Okay. But what I think ultimately I am preparing myself for is to be bedridden for extended periods of my life.
Well, you're certainly prepared. You've got the DVDs.
You know, people always prepare earthquake kits and roadside assistant kits. No, for me, it's about, hey, what happens when you're in that skydiving accident, you break both your legs?
Have you been skydiving?
I have, many, many times.
You have not?
I have.
You're lying.
This time I am not, sir. No, I really enjoy it. I haven't done it in a while, but I
got, actively skydive.
I actively skydove for a few years. Yeah.
Really?
Yeah.
You like the free fall and everything?
The free fall and a solo jump.
Not the being carabiner. I'm connected by duct tape to some dude.
No, I did
who's
two.
Who's just saying, smile at the camera, Sam.
I did two tandem jumps and then several solo jumps.
What makes you begin that?
It was something I'd always wanted to do. And then John Daly, on his birthday in 2005, said, I want to go skydiving. Who's in? And two of his friends, myself included, and his dad, we all went.
Well, that's great.
It was wonderful.
That's great. But you don't do it anymore. Now, why is that? You just felt like, I have the thrill.
Yeah, it's not that I don't do it anymore. It's that I have not had the desire to do it. I would go again if a good opportunity presented itself, but this is going to sound ridiculous, but I one of my early jumps, my first solo jump, in fact, I had a pretty major malfunction with my chute and my altimeter.
What happened to your altimeter and your
My altimeter stuck at 8,000 feet, which is fine. If you're at 8,000 feet, you have plenty of time to fix things that go wrong.
But you can look around and say, you know, I think I'm actually dropping, so this must be wrong.
Right. I look down. The problem is when you glance at your altimeter, unless you really want to not bore yourself, but you want to experience the jump.
Of course.
So you don't want to just stare at your altimeter and watch it tick down to when you pull your chute.
Yeah.
You want to look around. You want to make some turns. You want to enjoy yourself. And so you glance at your altimeter for just a half second, and I glance down and it says 8,000 feet. And then I glance over at my diving instructor who's falling next to me, and he is giving me the pull your ripcord right this very second finger hand sign.
Yes,
that's
saying,
how you communicate
you're done.
Up there.
Go pull
like
it.
I don't understand why you haven't pulled yet. You know. And then I'm thinking to myself, what? I'm at 8,000 feet, and I glance back, and I'm at 2,000 feet because my altimeter had frozen at 8,000.
Uh-huh.
And then I glance over at him, and then I glance back, and in that 1 second difference, it shot down to 2,000 feet. So
lesson being, when you look at your altimeter, kind of tap it with your
just
index
tap
finger.
It. You want to
just tap. Give it a tap.
And what was worse was I noticed that it stuck on the way up in the airplane, and I pointed it out to my instructor, and he said, don't worry about it.
Ah.
And then I pulled.
And then, so you pulled.
I pull my chute.
Your
and then
primary.
You're correct. I pull my primary chute, and it did not catch all the air that it needed to catch for me to. I could have landed with the amount of air that was catching, and to be honest, I probably would have broken a leg or an ankle because I was probably falling at that point 20, 25 miles per hour.
Yeah.
So it would have knocked the wind out of me. I could have gotten pretty banged up. But I knew it was not a complete opening because I had done training before that solo jump. And so I was doing everything I could to get it to fully inflate. And I said to myself, all right, I'm going to try once more before I cut away and go to my reserve. Because I knew I was dangerously low.
Well, you're 2,000 feet. I guess that's pretty low.
The ceiling for that is about 1,500 feet, unless you are a pro.
Mm-hmm.
You don't want to cut away beneath 1,500. Once you hit that mark, whatever you're riding with, you're riding it all the way to the ground with.
So you literally you took out a knife and cut it?
Well, no, the cutting away in a nice chute like that, a Ram Air parachute, it's you just pull one cord and it releases it for you, and then you pull your reserve. But I did not have to do that. Mercifully, on my last attempt to fully inflate my primary, it opened.
When your primary chute is fluttering like that, maybe in a line, in an incomplete line, and you're still going very fast to the ground,
yeah.
Does anything in your head happen, or were you being, you know, you are Chuck Norris, you are MacGyver, you are just figuring it out?
You know, I did not panic because I had just that very morning done a 6-hour training course on every possible malfunction, and my instructor would not let me go up in the air until I could demonstrate to him how to fix every one of those major malfunctions in a matter of seconds. And I did very well in the course. I'm happy to say I took to it quickly. And so I felt pretty confident that when the problem happened, I immediately identified it and began performing the procedure to fix it.
Excellent.
Yeah.
So but before we get off all of these thousands, millions of DVDs that we're surrounded by, what are two of your favorites?
That's a good question. Let me glance.
Let me see
there.
The Sum of All Fears. That must be your favorite.
It's up there.
Come on.
Well, you got The Godfather in there.
The Godfather. Oh, well, you have the big Godfather poster.
Yeah, that's an Italian.
What is it about you guys from New Jersey that just love The Godfather? It's an excellent movie. It is brilliantly done and everything. But when you go to a person like yourself from New Jersey who's steeped in that culture,
is that representational
of the culture that you came from?
I'm going to stop you right there. The poster is on my wall, and I'm a big fan of that movie, not because I'm from New Jersey, but because I am a fan of films, especially good ones. The Godfather.
I'll have to put music that sounds glittery when you say that.
Yeah, please do.
A glissando on the
go ahead. Add something in post.
So
it's a perfect movie. It is. It's a perfect movie. It's a perfect story.
When you think of a perfect movie, what do you mean?
Not like
The Sum of All Fears?
No, not like The Sum of All Fears. It works on every level. There's not a moment of that movie that I think reeks of incredulity or I have to suspend my disbelief. Every piece works.
Wait a minute. Are these things alphabetized?
Yes, they are.
Because I'm looking at it, I'm seeing, On the Waterfront, great movie. One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest. With Open Range, Open Water. Wow, that's Orange County.
Well, it's starring our good friend Colin Hanks.
Yes, of course. And then we get into the P's. Parenthood and Panic Room. Two of the biggies.
Parenthood is a great comedy.
How do you buy the DVD of Panic Room? Just how do you see that and go, oh, yeah, it's...
Because you're a David Fincher fan.
Oh, so you just... Panic Room.
I own all of David Fincher's films, with the exception of The Curious Case of Benjamin Button.
And why do you not own that?
That's a good question. Probably because I'm at the age now where previously I had been concerned with if I owned, say, 4 out of 5 films of a specific director, I would have a compulsive need to get that fifth film, to have the complete set. But now I'm at the point where I know if it's a film that I saw and wasn't completely in love with, I would probably never watch it again. And then I'm just filling up space on a bookshelf and out $25.
Yes. You have To Live and Die in L.A., Tommy Boy, and Traffic, and Training Day. Training Day, those kinds of movies where you just think, really?
Yeah.
You have a lady friend or some guys who come over and you just go like, hey, idea, couple of pizzas, Training Day.
Training Day, followed by Traffic and Tommy Boy, triple feature everyone always wants to do.
But you enjoy it. Do you find you watch these a lot?
I do find that I watch them quite a bit. Especially when I travel, which is kind of a hassle. Now that everything's all digitized, you don't really need to do this. But for years...
But do you put them in the DVD drive of your computer and watch it on a plane
or something?
Yeah, for years
before Netflix and streaming, movies and whatnot, I would pack up a disc wallet of 20, 30 movies.
Sure. Now, you've... Since our very nice experience, certainly mine, of working with you.
Oh, mine was tremendous.
On Freaks and Geeks.
You were a professional. And hysterical, by the way.
Was I?
You were very phenomenally funny on that show.
Oh.
How dare you?
Oh.
How dare you play coy, sir?
I think both you and I have interesting, self-deprecating, even with a sharp edge to it, humor about ourselves.
I think you were right.
Which is I don't know. It's interesting.
Well...
Where do you think yours came from? Because
never...
you even had it then. You have the sense. Is it the comic?
Because
I'm going to make fun of myself before anyone gets there, so I beat you to the punch?
Absolutely. That is how I acted before I became an actor when I was a young man. And like I said at the beginning of this, I was not a popular kid. I was a weird kid. I did not have a lot of friends. I often had to diffuse what could have otherwise been uncomfortable situations as a young man with whatever humor I could conjure. And so I was always the first one in a situation where I thought maybe a bigger guy was going to pick on me. And I would say, wait, hang on. Before you hit me, I want to see if there's anyone a lot smaller than me I can punch afterward because I'm not hitting you back.
Right, right.
And that would often... the situation would turn into a laughter. All right, whatever. I'm not going to hit you. You're funny. You get a pass today. And so I guess that was something I had gravitated towards. And also, the two types of humor that I find funny are extraordinarily overconfident when the personality and the person does not call for it, such as a Ron Burgundy type.
Mm-hmm.
And then very self-deprecating, don't pay attention to me, I'll just sit here in the dark, kind of Conan O'Brien type of, mm-hmm. of humor. I find those two to be the most funny.
So you've been working steadily for 12 years.
Yeah.
Since Freaks and Geeks.
Yep.
When young actors now come to you, ask you the Freaks and Geeks questions, mm-hmm. and say they're new in town.
Yeah.
What kind of advice do you give them?
Well, there is the advice I give to people I just want to be nice to. And
what's that advice?
I say, hey, man, just stay here as long as you can. Keep at it. Don't get discouraged. There's a lot of ups and downs. This is not a thing you try for a year or two. You're in it to win it for a long, long time.
And what's the real advice?
I say, if there is anything else in your life that gives you joy, that you gravitate towards, that you enjoy doing and could see yourself doing and be fulfilled, do that. Because this is a business that for 99.99% of the people who attempt it are going to be disappointed.
Have the triumphs for you outshone the disappointments?
I'd like to say yeah, but I'm human, so frequently I think about the jobs I came that close to or the pilot that I did that I loved and wanted to run 10 years that didn't get picked up, or, maybe if I'd have just stayed in that audition room and said that one more thing, maybe that would have turned the... So, it can get very defeating at times, but I try to really enjoy the successes when they come and never, ever allow myself to think, I deserve this.
Mm-hmm.
Because once you start with that mindset, once you start thinking you deserve success in this business, you are setting yourself up for horrible disappointment and alcoholism.
So what is it that keeps you going now? What is it that you find exciting that kid in New Jersey in Fort Lee found exciting about being on the stage in front of people? Since now you're more often on a television set, on a movie set, than on a stand-up stage.
Sure.
So what...
I still have as much enjoyment shooting anything. Could be an $80 million movie in Berlin or a $500 funded web series. I love the time between action and cut so much that I would, and do often, do it for free.
Right.
Or near to it.
It's that time between action and cut.
I love that part of my day more than any other part of my day.
Great. How can people find you, Sam?
You can find me on Twitter, at Sam Levine, SammLevine. You can find me on Facebook until they max me out on how many people I'm allowed to add. And you can see me this winter on NBC's Do No Harm, supposedly airing Sunday nights at 10 p.m.
Do No Harm on Sunday nights. So is that a doctor
it's a,
show?
It's a, yeah, it is. It's a medical drama with a Jekyll and Hyde twist.
Who are you playing on Do No Harm?
I play an administrative assistant.
As well you should.
Well, you look at me and you think, that guy's not a doctor, but I'll bet he works with doctors.
I think almost dentist.
Like my father.
Yes, that's right.
And my fictional father.
There's still time. Oh, yeah, and your dad on the show, huh?
That's how that happened, because my real father came to set, and when I introduced him to Judd and Paul, and he said, what do you do? He said, I'm a dentist. They went, of course you are. Of course Neil's dad is a dentist. Let it be.
Thanks, Sam.
My pleasure. Thank you, Tom.
Well, he had to answer the phone a couple times, but it was important. It was his manager and his agent and Hollywood and business calls, and he was trying to make some deal happen or something. So,
But Sam's a good guy. I really enjoyed talking with him. And thanks, Sam, for being on. Thanks to Emily Wilson for producing. Thanks to Chris and Katie, everybody over at Nerdist Industries. Thanks to McPherson Guitars for helping me out on my live show. Thanks to, thanks to everybody who's downloaded the book, The Masked Man by me, Tom Wilson, off of the Kindle Store or the Apple Store. Do that if you haven't. But thanks so much. Please consider subscribing to the podcast or telling a friend about it, and I will talk to you next time. Time. Wow. My voice is really going. Time. Bye.
Now leaving Nerdist.com.